This is the Breaker.News podcast for the week of April 16th, 2023. I'm Bob Mackin, publisher of the Breaker.News and host of the Breaker.News podcast. Welcome to edition number 286. The Breaker is your source for news, opinion, and analysis about British Columbia issues, institutions, and influencers. Later, I'll tell you how you can support The Breaker. On this edition, headlines from the Pacific Rim and the Pacific Northwest. I award a virtual Nanaimo bar to a difference maker. And on the big deal feature, hear from two women from two of my favorite islands, Ireland and Taiwan. Louise O'Reilly is a member of the Irish Assembly from Dublin. She joined me during her trip to Vancouver to mark the 25th anniversary of the Good Friday Agreement. And Angel Liu, the Director General of the Taipei Economic and Cultural Office in Vancouver, joined me to talk about the importance of Canada-Taiwan relations at a key time in history. This is the Big Deal feature on the Breaker.News podcast. Two islands, one in the Pacific, the other in the Atlantic, the source of many British Columbians, trading partners, travel destinations, democracies, but both with challenges, Ireland and Taiwan. First, Taiwan, where 10 members of Canada's Parliament visited last week. The self-governing democracy is the size of Vancouver Island, but with 23 million people. They live in the shadow of communist China, which threatens to invade. The U.S. has promised to defend Taiwan should China attack. The MPs from four parties arrived in capital Taipei as China was winding up 3 days of war games in retaliation for President Tsai Ing-wen's meeting with U.S. House Speaker Kevin McCarthy in Los Angeles. Angel Liu is the Director General of the Taipei Economic and Cultural Office in Vancouver, Taiwan's de facto consulate in B.C. Angel Liu talked with me about the importance of the visit by Canadian lawmakers to Taiwan, what they would learn, and how the two countries can benefit from a closer relationship at a time when both are facing a hostile China.
The significance of this delegation actually is to show their friendly support to Taiwan's democracy and how Taiwan can learn, how Canada can learn from Taiwan to fight against Chinese disinformation campaign and the interference campaign against a foreign country. So I think that is part of the purpose of this delegation. And and we are the parliamentary delegation is, according to the president, it is just a routine visit, and it is not an exception at all. So we don't want the Chinese side to overreact toward it.
It shouldn't be anything unusual for people from democracies to go visit other democracies. Canada, exactly. Canadian politicians meet American politicians, British politicians come over to the U.S. This shouldn't be anything unusual or dangerous at all.
We don't want to let the Chinese government feel that they can decide which friend Taiwan government can make and which friend not to make.
And it's also an important time because the talks about an investment agreement both governments want to start talking about that investment agreement.
We are glad that in Canada's Indo-Pacific strategy and also in the recent interim report released by the Canada PRC Special Committee in the Canadian Parliament, the report about Taiwan-Canada relations, both would like to urge the Canadian government to forge a closer ties with Taiwan in economic and trade and technology, education, and Indigenous affairs. So a lot of the areas that we can work together in non-sensitive issues.
Mm-hmm. And also that report recommended that the Canadian government make a public statement to China to not increase any of the threats to Taiwan. Yeah, I think one of the most important recommendations of the 18 was to say that the future of Taiwan should be in the hands of the Taiwanese people.
And we oppose Beijing's expansionist actions that threaten the status quo across the Taiwan Strait.
That was quite an ambitious trip that the president made not only to two allies, but to stop first in New York and on the way back in Los Angeles, and to meet a lot of people in the Taiwanese communities on both sides of the United States.
Actually, this kind of presidential transit in the United Territory is not the first time. It has happened many, many times before, no matter which party is in power in Taiwan. Like when I was working in Los Angeles from 2012 to 2018, there have been many, many times of presidential transit in LA, like this time, what President Tsai has done. And I believe President Tsai with U.S. House Speaker Kevin McCarthy have been meaningful in that the U.S. government and Congress has shoulder their support to Taiwan's democracy facing with Chinese increasing military escalation in the Taiwan Strait and its coercion in diplomatic and economic front toward Taiwan's international participation, like what it has done to force one of our diplomatic ally, Honduras, away from our country. And the other thing is, in addition to the military threat, actually, there's a very progressive disinformation, cognitive warfare that the PRC launched against Taiwan to try to influence the public opinion and try to coerce Taiwanese people toward the political end that the PRC would like to obtain.
The president, on her trip, met with a new speaker, Kevin McCarthy, who's from the Republican Party, but he basically expressed the same sentiments that Nancy Pelosi did. Two different years, two different people, but the same sentiment that Taiwan has the support of the U.S.
It shows a bipartisan support from the U.S. Congress to support Taiwan in providing defensive military assistance against the Chinese military aggression, and also to show that we have a strong bipartisan support from the U.S. Congress to support Taiwan's democracy and the cooperation of economic fronts such as supply chain resilience and semiconductor industry that we can work together in the following years. There are many areas that we can talk about to safeguard Taiwan's democracy. And not only the United States, but also in the aftermath of the 3 days military drills that mimicked a whole Taiwan blockade, Japanese government and EU executive committee all expressed their serious concern of the Chinese military aggression. And because the peace and stability in the Taiwan Strait is also meaningful to those countries adjacent the Indo-Pacific area.
What is Taiwan doing in advance of the election to protect itself from disinformation, from hacking, to make sure that that election is conducted with full integrity, that there is no cheating or undermining by the People's Republic of China, which could view that as an opportunity, like it has viewed Canadian elections as an opportunity to further its power and its interference and influence. What is Taiwan doing, and also what can Taiwan teach Canada to do in that respect?
Actually, we are not only doing this from now because of the presidential election is coming and we are facing more aggressive cognitive warfare from the PRC. We are doing many, many years ago in prepared or fighting against such warfare from PRC. The executive yuan, the executive branch from the Taiwanese executive yuan has established a branch to be in charge of this cognitive warfare situation, and we will identify and debunk any kind of disinformation that show up in the online chatting platform. And the government agency also cooperate with NGO to fact check any kind of fake news that could disrupt the Taiwanese population's trust on the government, and that might disrupt the social social accountability on the government. So there is a whole of the government approach to fight against the Chinese cognitive warfare against Taiwan. And we have many very well-known NGOs such as Taiwan Foundation for Democracy, and also very outstanding scholars in the academia, Seneca, such as Wu Jianming, and et cetera. They are very well-known scholars that have done such Chinese influence operation for years, and there are plenty of examples that can show people that this is China's information campaign. And then, as you may be aware, the Sunflower Movement, before that, there is a pro-China media campaign in Taiwan taking place in 2012. That is to show that we don't want to be coerced by the media campaign by the PRC.
That was Angel Liu, the Director General of the Taipei Economic and Cultural Office in Vancouver. Now to Ireland, the land of my forefathers, who hailed from County Louth, the wee county. The Good Friday Agreement of April 10, 1998, between politicians in Northern Ireland and the leaders of the Republic of Ireland and the United Kingdom helped end a period of more than 30 years of sectarian violence that took the lives of 3,700 people. Voters in the mainly Catholic Republic and voters in the mainly Protestant North ratified the agreement 6 weeks later on May 22, 1998. The 25th anniversary of the signing of the Peace and Power Sharing Agreement was marked in BC by the visit of Louise O'Reilly, a member of the Irish Parliament, known in Gaelic as the Dáil Éireann, and she's a member of the Sinn Féin Party. You may have heard of the left-wing Republican Party. It was once considered the political wing of the Irish Republican Army. But when the IRA called a ceasefire in 1997, it was a major step towards ending the Troubles. A major step toward ending conflict, and it was also the beginning of an era of cooperation. Louise O'Reilly represents the Dublin Fingal riding. She was elected in 2016 and re-elected in 2020. She is Sinn Féin's critic for workers' rights, enterprise, trade, and employment. Louise O'Reilly spoke with me on April 11th in Vancouver. So welcome to Vancouver. You're speaking in New Westminster tonight. People, of course, will be hearing my podcast later. But talk about what you'll be telling people in New Westminster at this symposium.
Well, I suppose in the first instance, I'm going to be celebrating, because we should, 25 years of an international peace agreement, which has stood the test of time and may not have delivered on every single one of its possibilities, but, you know, will in time, I believe, deliver for us a united Ireland through, obviously, peaceful and democratic means, and by a popular vote of the people. I think that that is coming. So I'll be saying to people this evening, you know, this is a time for us to celebrate. Our agreement has endured. And, you know, there were people at the time who would not have given the agreement much of a chance, didn't think it was going to work. And yet it has withstood this. I say it hasn't fulfilled all of its potential, but it has certainly withstood the test of time. I'm also going to speak about the importance of our international relations and the really positive role that countries like Canada play in terms of being on the side always of peace, being on the side always of reconciliation. You know, I think we can learn quite a lot from Canada in terms of reconciliation as well. And obviously with your own Indigenous people here and that movement, I think there's a lot for us to look, to watch, to learn, but also to say to people that, you know, I believe, and Sinn Féin believes, that in the next 10 years, if we plan it correctly, we could win a referendum on Irish unity. But we need to start the work to plan that now. That's not going to happen overnight. If we learned nothing else from Brexit, we learned the folly of making a big, massive decision without doing the necessary groundwork and without knowing exactly what it is that you're stepping into. So, you know, we believe that the time is now for the government in Dublin and indeed in London to start making preparations. But we would like to see the Irish government, the Dublin government, set up a citizens' assembly on unity. And I will talk about that this evening. And I will ask the people in the audience to think themselves if there is anything that they can do, anything positive that they can do in terms of political pressure or, you know, pressure through enterprise and business, to let it be known to the Irish government that, you know, the international community is watching, and that the international community would like to see a citizens' assembly on Irish unity as the first step in starting to plan. Because, you know, I've said it and I'll say it again, you know, we should learn a lesson from Brexit. You know, do not go blindly into a big decision without having done the homework and made the preparation. So the time to start to plan is now. And we believe that a referendum, North and South, as is provided for within the terms of the Good Friday Agreement, we believe that that will happen in the next decade. And when it happens, and we hope it does happen, but we want to win it. So in order to be able to win it, we have to do the planning and the preparation. And just as with the conditions that were brought about for the signing of the Good Friday Agreement, it wasn't just a local treaty. It's an international treaty. And, you know, we would have had help from, from the Irish Canadian community, from the Irish American community, from the Irish Australian community, in getting that deal delivered. And that help, I think, is going to be required now to, you know, get the Citizens Assembly and really start the nuts and bolts planning and preparation for unity.
Do you remember where you were 25 years ago this week?
I tell you, I couldn't remember exactly where I was this week, but I did remember exactly where I was when I voted for the Good Friday Agreement. I was the mother to a very young child. She was 2.5 at that stage. And I recall myself and my husband were living in the inner city in Dublin, and my husband had forgotten to transfer his vote. So he had to get the bus to where his parents were living in Kildare. And I brought my daughter with me to vote. And I did, because on the day that I remember the deal being signed, and I remember listening to Morning Ireland, and they thought they'd have the deal for the morning breakfast, for the breakfast news show, and they didn't. And I remember watching, and I remember being hopeful, very, very hopeful. I lived for 10 years in a border town. So that was from when I was about 5.5, 6 up to when I was 16. I lived in Dundalk, just up from Drogheda, as you'll be familiar with. So I lived in Dundalk for that time. We wanted the conflict to be over, but we also wanted a route that we could get to Irish unity by peaceful and democratic means. And I remember my parents and talking to them at the time, and they celebrated, you know, we did too. And, you know, there were a lot of people who were skeptical about how well the agreement would endure and whether or not it would be enough. And, you know, there was very tense negotiations. I wasn't part of them, but obviously as an Irish person, I was watching them very closely. Very tense negotiations right up until the last minute. And when George Mitchell said, "Look, I'm going home for Easter, lads. This is either getting done or we'll lose this momentum." And just to see them seize the momentum and get it over the line at the last minute. And then to look back now, 25 years on, at how robust and enduring that agreement was is quite the thing, because there were plenty of detractors at the time. But I remember listening to the likes of Gerry Adams and John Hume and others being interviewed, and they said, you know, "We think this will last. We think this will hold." And, you know, to know that and to see the that peaceful and democratic way to a new and united Ireland laid out in word form, and also the peace that it brought with it for my friends who lived in the north and my friends who lived along the border, that was incredibly important. You know, people that meant a lot to people, and the endurance of that international peace treaty has meant a huge lot to Irish people.
If you're here while U.S. President Joe Biden is over in Ireland, and I think he's even visiting Dundalk too. He told the reporters that his goal is basically simple on this occasion, not just to commemorate the anniversary, but he said to keep the peace. You know, there are still some radical elements that prefer violence, but it's about keeping the peace.
It is, and you know, the radical elements are very, very, very tiny in number. The vast, vast majority of people on the island of Ireland have realised that there is a mechanism to achieve unity, and they have backed it. I mean, you only have to look at the overwhelming majority that backed the Good Friday Agreement at the first opportunity we had to vote on it. It was a very exciting time. So from the signing of the deal to the vote north and south, it was absolutely huge. It was an incredibly exciting time. But I think what we see now in the intervening time is the dividend. Now, not a fully realised dividend, I would say, but the dividend that is there for the young people, the people who now we call the Good Friday generation, those people who have grown up knowing only peace and no conflict. That in itself is a huge, huge prize for us to have our young people, north and south, growing up and only knowing peace and only hearing about the conflict from those who experienced it or from, you know, reading about it in books, but not actually living that. That's absolutely immense. And, you know, it has meant a huge amount to people in the north at the time. My father was, he's a union organizer. I'm a former union organizer myself. He was the leader of a union, an all-island union. There's headquarters in both Belfast and Dublin. And he would have been very heavily invested in, you know, wanting to get on with the business of representing his members and, you know, doing wage agreements and that. And you know, to have that, the opportunity presented there and the, you know, all of the efforts that went into getting the agreement across the line to then see the dividend that came from it. And it didn't come immediately. But for those young people who are now 25 and over, to hear them talk when they only have heard about conflict from their parents or their grandparents, and it's becoming a distant memory, and they get to live their life in peace. That, you know, you can't put a price on that.
This whole peace process is to allow people who were once enemies to work together, to invest together, to trade together, to build businesses together. That's been one of the areas that has benefited the most.
Oh, 100% it is. And, you know, we see with Brexit most recently and the special status arrangement that the North of Ireland has, you know, that has improved, not just improved the number of people in employment, which is important, but it's improved the quality of the jobs, which is even more important, and the quality of the pay, which is equally as important. So, you know, there is a lot going on. We've a huge natural resource, you know, and by natural resource, I mean our people, our young people, you know, English speaking, incredibly well educated workforce that is now on the you know, the potential is there on the 32 in every one of the 32 counties to be unlocked. And I think one of the kind of the values of the Good Friday Agreement, or one of the most valuable things about it, was that at the time, 25 years ago, people turned all of their eyes to Dublin and Belfast in a really positive way. And it was like, look what the Irish are doing there. Look how they are building peace. Look how they are, you know, coming to an agreement. Look how they're, and look at with every agreement, you know, that there's going to be some compromises. But it showcased the island of Ireland in a fantastic and positive way, which I think is really, really important. And, you know, the dividend for peace is when, you know, when there's no conflict, people can get about the business of, you know, building building up their society. The difficulty for a lot of people who live in the north is that the government in London maybe is somewhat less interested, you might say, in the affairs of the north than maybe in the affairs of England, or, you know, places that are closer to London. And I think that, you know, what Brexit has shown is the people in the north voted to remain inside the European Union, but they were taken out by the majority vote, yes, but not a majority in the north voting for it. They were taken out of the European Union. They now have special status, which has given them an opportunity once again to showcase, you know, what they can do and where their talents are. And we have a very good education system. There's a lot of cross-border cooperation and trade that goes on, because now we don't have a visible border. So, you know, that was the other really physical manifestation of the Good Friday Agreement, was the removal of the border infrastructure. So when I was growing up, I lived in Dundalk, we used to go up to Newry for swimming we love swimming in my house. All of us love to swim. There's no swimming pool in Dundalk, so we'd cross the border to go swimming. Like, there's times you'd have to queue for an hour and a half to get across the border. Like, people remember that. That's not there anymore. There's seamless travel and seamless trade across the border, and it has benefited the North, I think, quite a lot. But it has also focused people's mind on the potential that exists there. You know, I mean, who would have thought, you know, 20 years ago that a show like Game of Thrones would not just be driving film production, and it is, but there is a thriving tourist industry that comes directly off. And I'm not, I'm not a Game of Thrones fan. I've never watched it. But my God, the people who are love it, and they will travel and travel in large numbers to be able to see it. So, and that's people seeing the island of Ireland in a really, really positive way. And, you know, when we have a lot that we can be very, very rightly very proud of in terms of, you know, foreign direct investment, tech jobs and all of that. But we also have a lot of potential, which I think is the exciting thing. So as we're marking 25 years of the Good Friday Agreement, I think we're looking also at the resources that we have, both natural and economic, etc. And we're saying, OK, what more can we do? And, you know, there was a confidence that came about immediately following the signing of the Good Friday Agreement, a kind of a positivity that came about as a result of it. And that, I think, has been growing for the last 25 years. Now, look, it hasn't all been, you know, milk, honey and sunshine, but it's certainly it has been a very positive development, and particularly for young people who are growing up without any knowledge or experience of conflict, and are growing up to know possibilities. And, you know, there's more people going to third level education now. That's, you know, incredibly important. And they are making a contribution to the image of Ireland as a forward thinking, forward looking, well educated, dynamic place, not just to work, but also to live.
It's very important, especially in this post-Brexit age, because any border would be an impediment to trade, to families.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And the elimination of the border was incredibly important, the removal of the physical infrastructure, and what followed then, the special arrangement, the special status. It was Sinn Féin who had called initially for special status for the North, purely and simply because it's the only part of Britain that has a land border with the European Union, which, you know, runs along down past Dundalk, et cetera, et cetera. So, we would have called for that special status. Now that that is there, when you talk to business people, they want to keep that special status. They want to be able to trade with the European Union, trade with Britain, and also to showcase the talent that they have. So, you know, in terms of the economy in the North, the economy is doing better than it is in London. In London, they're about to head into a recession. In the North, it's slightly different because they can, they are seeing their business grow, and they are seeing investment, which is really, really good. And they're seeing a lot of foreign investment that will come because, you know, capital being what it is, it will go to the place where it can be most productive. And, you know, if you have a young, educated, willing workforce, and you've got a government and a structure that is willing to work with you, that's all to the good and all positive. And there's the elimination of the border infrastructure, there was a major psychological impact to that, but practically speaking, it just made trade easier.
So what next for Ireland beyond this 25th anniversary? What next for you here in Canada on your tour?
Well, this evening, obviously, we have an event in New Westminster, and then tomorrow I'm heading to Calgary. And again, I will speak to people who are Irish American, to business people, to entrepreneurs, to people who are interested in Ireland, interested in trade. I'm a member of the Parliamentary Friendship Group, the Ireland Canada Parliamentary Friendship Group, and a member of the Enterprise Trade and Employment Committee that sits in Dáil Éireann. And we are looking at the moment, we're about to embark on a piece of work where we will be looking at the possibilities that exist for deepening the trading relationship between Ireland and Canada. Also looking, you know, as in Ireland, you have a housing crisis here. So looking at to see what way other people internationally are addressing their housing and homeless crisis. And I think there's a lot that we can learn from each other. There's a real willingness that I'm picking up among not just Irish Canadians and or people from the Irish Canadian community, but also, you know, from talking to people, they see that Ireland is a good and a decent place to do business. They're concerned the same as everyone is in relation to housing, and that's a huge issue for people, and that is an impediment to trade and one that we are going to have to deal with. But I think people see the young, educated workforce that we have. We're English speaking. We are now the only English speaking state within the European Union. That plus the special status for the North means that the possibilities are there for us to do really well. And I suppose, much and all, as it's great to celebrate the 25 years, we have to do more than that. We can't simply go, we've made it to 25 years now, pat on the back, didn't we do well? It's about looking forward, and for us, looking forward, we're looking forward to the prospect of a unity referendum north and south in the next 10 years, and obviously that's part of the project. But we also know that we are going to need to broaden out our base in terms of investment and deepen the relationships that we have internationally. We're a small country with a large diaspora, so you know we have a lot of advantages that other countries don't have, and we need to be able to make the most of those and to be able to say to people, you know, we can provide, and I do hope the next government is led by my party president, Mary Lou MacDonald, and I do hope to see not only Mary Lou as the first woman Taoiseach, which would be very, very special, but the first sort of non-Fine Gael or Fianna Fáil Taoiseach as well, which I think would be interesting and very good for our country. And you know, unity is part of that. Unity is part of our agenda, but also building our economy and ensuring that we have a stable base. We have a very heavy reliance on corporation tax receipts, which, you know, capital being what it is, capital is mobile. You know, they're here today, they could be gone tomorrow. So we need to broaden out our own indigenous base. We need to find new markets, and we also need to find ways of sustainably trading. And that is going to be a big, big challenge. But we have some of the brightest and the best minds in Europe working hard in Ireland. And, you know, the hope is that we will be able to build on that. And again, you know, on the 25th anniversary of the Good Friday Agreement, you see people, the eyes of the world focus, maybe only for a brief period, but the eyes of the world focus on Ireland. Celebrate our achievement. It's a really positive thing, and it's a great thing for us to be in the news for something as positive as marking the 25 years. But if that was all we did, I think we'd be letting down people like, you know, Gerry Adams and those who were the architects of the Good Friday Agreement. It was never intended to be a race to 25 years and that's it, done. You know, didn't we do well? The intention is that we will build on that. But it is nice to have the eyes of the world focus on us in a very, very positive way. But as I said, that's not the only thing. There's serious work that needs to be done to make good on all of the potential of the Good Friday Agreement.
The 25th anniversary of the Good Friday Agreement, an example for the world about how people with differences can get together and build something new, build something peaceful. So thanks again for joining us on the Breaker.News podcast.
Thank you.
It's time on the Breaker.News podcast for Around the Rim. We look at news headlines around the Pacific Rim. In the Taiwan news, Taiwan prepares for economic blockade by China. Foreign ministry believes blockade more likely than military attack. The government is preparing with the help of friendly nations, Deputy Foreign Minister Roy Chun-Li told Bloomberg. Taiwan sped up the stockpiling of crucial products and minerals over the past 2 years. He saw concern from the private sector and from foreign investors about the geopolitical risks of investing in Taiwan or the region, though that has not been reflected by data. In Kyoto news, India tops Japan in new car sales amid high economic growth. India became the world's third largest automaker after China and the United States. New car sales in India in fiscal 2022 jumped 28.2% from a year ago to 4.85 million units. The figure topped the 4.39 million new vehicles sold in Japan as the emerging subcontinent market continues to expand on the back of high economic growth and an increasing population. In Hong Kong Free Press, half of Hong Kongers unable to name any serving lawmaker, poll finds. 12% of respondents to a recent poll failed to name a current lawmaker correctly, while 50% could not name any, according to findings from the Hong Kong Public Opinion Research Institute. Hong Kong's first Patriots-only legislature election took place in December following a Beijing-mandated overhaul of the electoral system that minimized the role of Democrats. It saw the lowest turnout in the city's history.
That's Around the Rim on this edition of the Breaker.News podcast.
Now it's time on the Breaker.News podcast for Cascadia Calling. We look at news headlines around the Pacific Northwest. In the Oregonian, Montana TikTok ban approved by state lawmakers would be first in U.S. The state house voted 54-43 to pass the bill, which goes further than prohibitions in place in nearly half the states and the U.S. federal government that prohibit TikTok on government devices. Montana already bans the app on state-owned devices. The measure now goes to Republican Governor Greg Gianforte for his consideration. In King 5, fire aboard ship in Tacoma put out after burning 6 days. The ship, which is owned by Trident Seafoods, caught fire over the weekend and led to a shelter-in-place order for nearby residents over air quality concerns. The next step is removing the fuel that remains on board. One complication in fighting the fire was the presence of 19,000 pounds of Freon on board the Kodiak Enterprise. Heat from the fire could cause pressure to build in the Freon tanks, according to the U.S. Coast Guard. In the Times Colonist, Souk Marine Business pays price for boat builders' controversial signs. Backlash against a sign referencing an anti-trans video has been mistakenly directed at another Souk company, which has received negative reviews and even threats. The most recent sign for Barry Marine to attract backlash said, quote, "Get them woke Bud Lights out for target practice," end quote, a reference to a video posted on Twitter by musician Kid Rock shooting up cans of Bud Light. Owner Andy Barry posted a sign 6 months ago that said, quote, "I identify as a boat builder. Does that mean I qualify for my own bathroom?" end quote. That's Cascadia Calling on this edition of the Breaker.News podcast. It don't matter what color you are, 'cause love will conquer hate, so you won't stand alone, you won't stand alone. The Virtual Nanaimo Bar, brought to you by Spruce Hill Contracting.
Every week we end the Breaker.News podcast on a tasty note by awarding the goodness of a virtual Nanaimo Bar to people making a difference. A virtual version of the province's favorite dessert bar goes this week to
authors of BC published books and readers of BC published books. It's BC Book Day on April 17th, part of Creative Industries Week, which runs April 17th to 21st. Find a BC book. Go to bcbooklook.com.
You can nominate someone for a virtual Nanaimo Bar. Send me an email to bob@thebreaker.news. Spruce Hill Contracting, custom homes and renovations. Find more information at sprucehill.ca.
That's it for the Breaker.News podcast for the week of April 16th, 2023. I'm Bob Mackin. Thanks for joining me. Did you know that on the 16th of April in 1910, Boston Arena opened in, guess where, Boston? It is now known as Matthews Arena, and it is the oldest existing indoor hockey rink in the world. Now you know. Send me your feedback. Send me your story ideas to bob@thebreaker.news. Bookmark thebreaker.news. You can also find us at thebreaker.ca. Sign up for the email newsletter and get updates to your inbox. For news as it happens, follow The Breaker News on Twitter and visit TheBreaker.News on Facebook. You can support The Breaker for as little as $2 a month. For more information, go to patreon.com/TheBreakerNews. That's patreon.com/TheBreakerNews.
Until next week.